This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 14th episode. In this edition of the podcast, we review a JCENM article investigating the drivers of erythrocytosis in the trans male population, and we'll discuss important determinants of that complication. As we always do here, we will walk slowly through the methodology to understand how the authors came up with their results, their inferential methods, and think critically about their conclusions. As a quick reminder, I host Endocrine Feedback Loop, working as a general endocrinologist and serving as an associate fellowship program director at Vanderbilt in Nashville. Our regular contributor today, back for her second episode, is Anna Goldman. Anna is also a general endocrinologist and associate program director working at the Brigham in Boston. She has a special interest in reproductive endocrinology and co-directs the transgender health program at the Brigham. So we're particularly excited to have her involved for this episode. Today, Vin Tengprecha fills the role of guest expert, and I'm delighted to welcome into our virtual recording studio. Vin works at Emory in Atlanta, where he is the director of their fellowship program. His research interests are varied and include cystic fibrosis and osteoporosis. However, transgender medicine comprises a major component of his clinical and translational research, in addition to the care he provides to patients. So, as usual, we have two excellent folks to help us all understand this article better. Everything discussed today will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. Today's article, Erythrocytosis in a Large Cohort of Trans Men Using Testosterone, a Long-Term Follow-Up Study on Prevalence, Determinants, and Exposure Years, comes to us from the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam, the Free University of Amsterdam. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in June 2021 with Malou Cecilia Madsen as the first author. Anna, let me now turn things over to you to lead us through the author's introduction and to get Vin's input on several important aspects of clinical care in this field. Anna?
Thanks so much, Chase. So transgender and non-binary individuals experience dysphoria due to the incongruence between their gender identity and their sex assigned or recorded at birth. To reduce this stress, gender-affirming hormone therapy can be given to induce the desired physical and mental changes toward the experienced sex. Erythrocytosis is a known side effect of masculinizing therapy with testosterone that can increase the risk of thromboembolic events by an increase in blood viscosity. The highest risk of erythrocytosis seems to be with injectable testosterone when compared with transdermal testosterone, and this increase in hematocrit is greatest in the first 3 months to 1 year of administration. Then I was hoping that you would be able to go over the current guidelines of when to measure hematocrit, what we do if it's elevated, and what cutoff we should use.
First, thanks for having me on this podcast, Chase and Anna. This is a very exciting paper to discuss. In terms of the guidelines, the Endocrine Society Guidelines 2017 Hormone Therapy for Transgender, Gender Diverse People state that the hematocrit should be measured every 3 or 4 months in the first year, and then once or twice a year after you establish a steady and stable dose. So in this case, if the hematocrit is elevated, you would want to lower the dose. And the Endocrine Society, the transgender guidelines didn't specify a cutoff. It referred to the Endocrine Society hypogonadal guidelines. And that guideline says a cutoff of 54 for the hematocrit. So if the hematocrit is above 54, you should probably consider lowering the testosterone dose. Or I think what you really should do is just before you blame testosterone, do a workup and make sure it's not due to something else. And when we say something else, we're talking about things that are commonly causing hypoxia like smoking, or commonly I've been finding some sleep apnea. Some people tend to gain weight and may have obstructive sleep apnea. So I'll be asking about sleep habits, snoring. Smoking is an easy one. If you could ask people to stop smoking, that will help lower the hematocrit. But oftentimes we are talking about lowering the dose, especially if the testosterone level is out of the range.
So this study was undertaken to study the prevalence and determinants in the development of erythrocytosis in trans men on testosterone and to study the time relation between the duration of testosterone therapy and hematocrit levels over the course of 20 years. And I'll turn back to you, Chase, for the discussion points for the methods.
Anna, thanks. And Van, thanks as well for already highlighting some of the issues here and that in this specific population, there's not a lot of data to help guide care here and that we're often extrapolating or inferring from data from other populations. So I think understanding this is going to be really helpful to try to fill in some of those gaps of care here. So as we normally do, we're going to think broadly about inferential methods here. And part of it will be challenging for this study. And the reason for that is that the authors don't use any of the classic study designs that we typically talk about. So when we talk about classic study designs, we're thinking about either retrospective or prospective cohort studies, cross-sectional studies, case control studies, those sorts of observational investigations. This one doesn't do that. It comes from a cohort, but don't want that to be confused. A cohort is simply a collection of patients or subjects. It doesn't imply that it's a cohort study. This would not be considered a cohort study. And we're going to look at this a little bit later on in the methodology. But the reason that the investigators here chose a different approach is they wanted to capture and incorporate all of the repeated measurements that are done for these individuals over time. So as opposed to simply having a single time point where you get an outcome and then either deciding, is that dichotomous, is that yes or no, or if you want to make that finer based on degree of elevation, they wanted to capture this with multiple measurements over time. And as we'll look at here shortly, can be in different situations, meaning different types of testosterone or different amounts of testosterone that individuals are on. And so we'll think about that when we get later on into the particulars of the statistics, but that's why they chose this somewhat unusual approach. So a few words about the patients that are involved here. So this study is a part of the Amsterdam cohort of gender dysphoria study. And that entire cohort contains quite a few individuals, 6,793 people. And those are individuals who visited the Center of Expertise on Gender Dysphoria of Amsterdam. And a huge range of years here, all the way back from 1972 up to 2015. The lab measurements, which will be key for what we're talking about today, though, are from 2004 to 2018. And those were the ones that were available for the analysis for this paper. For the inclusion criteria, so to be included in this study, it was specifically a population of trans men who had started testosterone and had at least one follow-up visit after starting the testosterone. They were excluded if the testosterone treatment was discontinued in follow-up or if there was missing data, in particular, if you were missing the lab results or the starting date of testosterone, because those were key for what the authors were looking at here, that they excluded those individuals. And we'll look here in the results with Anna here shortly about what sort of an impact that had on how many individuals were excluded. The first thing that I wanted to do, though, is just get an input from Anna and from Van to think about these, particularly these exclusion criteria. And I was trying to think more and wrap my head around really this idea of excluding individuals if the testosterone treatment was discontinued and trying to think if we could potentially be missing cases of erythrocytosis here, if that might be why the testosterone was discontinued in the first place. It's not really expanded on and we don't have a great understanding, particularly for that exclusion criteria, what impact that had. And I know Anna or Van, if either of you have any thoughts on whether that would be likely to have an impact or not very likely.
Well, I just want to first say that this is the study from the Dutch cohort, as we name it. It's been a very valuable cohort. It's one of the oldest cohorts of trans people in the world. It may not be no longer the largest, with no more cohorts being started, but really an amazing cohort that we've learned so much over the past years in terms of safety of different hormone regimens, different comorbidities. You're right, Chase. It's not a cohort scientifically by design, but I guess it's more of a clinic-based study. These are all people who've been seen in the Dutch cohort, who've received different hormone therapies over the years, who've been followed very carefully. For my colleagues in Holland, everyone who identifies as transgender goes to that clinic. So, you know, you're pretty much capturing most of the people in that country that are getting gender-affirming care. So to your first point, in terms of follow-up, you know, I guess it would impact the results if the testosterone was discontinued because of a elevated hematocrit. I don't know if people may have moved to other countries. That could be another explanation why, you know, they just didn't have a follow-up visit. As my colleagues tell me, most of the people follow in the Amsterdam clinic. I mean, there may be other clinics all over Holland, which I assume probably is happening now with more increased knowledge of how to handle hormone therapy in transgender people. That could be another explanation. But certainly if people are being dropped out because they're having elevated hematocrit, you might have missed the magnitude of the elevation in hematocrit.
And Ben, I'll ask you a follow-up question based on that, then, since you have a little bit of familiarity with their setup there and also your own practice. Would this be likely if that were to occur, if erythrocytosis were to develop? How extreme would that have to be in these situations to actually stop testosterone therapy altogether, as opposed to, say, switching to a different regimen, or if you can't address any of these other contributors, you know, potentially thinking about something like a therapeutic phlebotomy as a last resort to get those levels?
Yeah, I think that it would have to be very, very extreme, because most people don't stop testosterone therapy, and we would either lower their dose, or as you mentioned, therapeutic phlebotomy, perhaps quarterly, or usually you're able to find a secondary cause in addressing that. But, you know, most people would continue on testosterone therapy, you know, unless there was another reason to discontinue it. I mean, most people, you need it for bone health. I mean, if you were to stop it completely, you would develop severe osteoporosis without any sex steroid replacement. So I don't think stopping is a good option. And I don't know what would be the other reason for losing people in the cohort. Everyone is followed in the clinic.
Good. That's helpful and gives us, I think, an understanding of how that setup works there. So then, Van Heer, I'll have another question for you to try to help us understand the approach that's used there and to compare and contrast that to approach in the United States, for example. So the way that the investigators here would adjust doses is that the doses and the administration of testosterone were adjusted based on the individual monitoring levels. And the goal and then the units used here are nanomoles per liter, so that if you were using a transdermal gel, you would shoot for somewhere between 10 and 30 nanomoles per liter. And then if it was injection, you would check that trough level, that nadir right before an injection, shooting for 10 to 15 nanomoles per liter there. Mm-hmm. So when you see those and look at that approach, would you say that that's fairly comparable to what a typical approach in the US or elsewhere would be, or would there be any differences there that we would need to be aware of?
They're pretty similar in the U.S. In the guidelines, they recommend mid-levels between shots that are in the middle of the range. For the conventional units, probably around 400 to 500 midway between shots would be good. If you like to measure, I like to keep the trough in the low end of the normal range, so then I can tell the patient you're always in the normal range. You never drop below 250, 300. If it's in the high end of the normal range, yeah, the trough, then I say, hey, you're going in high. You're likely going to go above the normal range. We've got to lower the dose. But I think it's really provider preference. Mid-cycle levels or trough levels, I think either approach is fine.
Good, but nothing sounds like that we would see here that would make us think that this might be a different approach than what would be used elsewhere and potentially then limit the applicability to a different population. So good to know.
No, I think it's a similar approach. I think that's why it's important to ask your patient and write in the chart when the blood test was taken, because you need to know in relation to the shot when the blood test taken. It's a totally different decision if it's right before a shot or mid-cycle.
And so now we're going to think about the outcomes that are used here, and the authors define several different outcomes that they're looking for, and we'll elaborate on that later, but several different cutoffs are what they would call erythrocytosis. And for that outcome to be positive, you had to repeatedly be at that level. So you had to have at least two measurements above a certain cutoff. And they looked at several different thresholds, the first one being a hematocrit of 50, the second one being 52, and then the third one, 54. And then with any measurement, when you had erythrocytosis or any measurement at all measuring that hematocrit level, that was linked to the testosterone route of administration immediately before that level was drawn. And as we think about the statistics here, I think several important things to mention. So we alluded to before the approach that was used to capture these repeated measurements over time, and they utilized a logistic mixed model analysis because that model deals very well with these repeated measurements over time. And the outcome, just like we said, was erythrocytosis. And what they wanted to identify were the determinants. That's the phrasing that they use here, the determinants that drove those outcomes. And when I was looking at what they listed as their determinants, in my mind, I found it helpful to really split those into two different categories. One category of determinants would be really what they're trying to understand, which is aspects of testosterone therapy. The other determinants are something that I would consider to be confounders. So important things to know about, but not really particularly giving you information about the testosterone itself. So if you think about it in that way, the testosterone related determinants would be the age at testosterone initiation, the testosterone level itself, and then the route of administration of testosterone, injection versus gel, for example. And then the potential confounders that were looked at, tobacco use, Ben mentioned already how important that was. BMI would be another one. And they had a host of predisposing conditions. Most of them were lung conditions. So thinking about things that would drive erythrocytosis. And those were the predisposing conditions that they wanted to try to understand. So always, as we look at these here, always want to think about potential other determinants, or really confounders is what we want to think about. Things that maybe should have been thought about and weren't, or things that just frankly, there's really not a good way to measure. And so that's why they couldn't be included, those unmeasured confounders. So Anna and Vin, anything that you all were able to think of that said, well, it would have been nice if we would have known more about this because maybe this or that could have also been driving erythrocytosis in this group.
Yeah, I think it would have been helpful to, you know, have more information about who these patients were. You know, for example, I take these predisposing conditions into mind when I'm thinking about starting testosterone on a patient. If I know that somebody is obese, like I am more likely to start that person on transdermal testosterone compared to the injections.
Yeah, I think presence of sleep apnea, I don't know if they would have that. I mean, that would feed into the hematocrit. You'd probably capture that in the BMI. I mean, I don't know if they would be completely overlapping. Creatinine, I don't know if they took that into account, but people with renal failure, the rate, you know, if you go the other way, you'd have more a risk of anemia and maybe other blood disorders. But, you know, these are minor, I guess, confounders. And I don't know if they had enough information on these other areas, but it would have been nice to have.
Yeah, I agree. I think overall, they did a good job of thinking about all those other drivers. But one thing that I think is always worth a mention is considering socioeconomic status. That is something that is often profoundly difficult to measure. And when they're clinic-based cohorts, that's often just information that's not there. Sometimes when it is more national cohorts that we see coming out of Europe in particular, sometimes that information is available. But that is often something that drives health outcomes in a variety of ways that we don't understand very well, but is profoundly difficult to measure. And so I think at least would need to be pointed out is if it's not there, it may be a contributor and nothing necessarily that could be done about it if it's not information that you have, but just an acknowledgement that would need to be made there. And finally, one last word on the statistics here, and that's the result that we're going to get, and that the result that the authors are going to present us with is an adjusted odds ratio. So a couple of comments on that. So one of the things that I think, first of all, is really helpful that the authors did, and I always like to point out, is that they included both the unadjusted and the adjusted odds ratio. So the way that with this analysis, the way that it works is you get odds for these, the relationship between the determinant and the exposure. And then when they compare them, that generates the odds ratio. And they would then adjust it for these other potential confounders that we've gone through already. And I think it is helpful when the authors present you, first of all, the unadjusted ones, and then you can see the impact of adjusting for these confounders. And the reason I think that's helpful is you get really worried is if your unadjusted odds ratios or relative risk or whatever it is that the authors are presenting is a particularly high number. So say it's 10, something fairly impressive. Mm-hmm. But then once you adjust for your confounders, if that number comes down dramatically and say it comes down to under 2, then you get really worried because you saw that adjusting for confounders dramatically reduce that impact. There are always going to be unmeasured confounders. And so you get worried that if those were accounted for, if they could be accounted for, then perhaps that ratio drops all the way to 1 and there isn't a difference there. So it's always nice to see the magnitude that change, and there's not hard and fast cutoffs, but to get a sense when you adjusted, what type of an impact did that make? So as we go through the results, we'll think about that, but I think it's a nice feature of this paper that the authors include that. One final word, though, that I think is worth pointing out, and this is just by nature of the analysis that is done, is you get only an odds ratio here. So we're going to have a sense, a relative sense of the different drivers here and how they would compare to one another. The challenge with having only this is that we don't understand the absolute impact here. So it can be very difficult. Anna's already presented a scenario to where she says, I've got a patient in front of me. I'm trying to choose which type of testosterone to give this individual. It can be hard to know, is to say, well, if I choose this over this, what is the absolute increase in a risk of erythrocytosis? We have a relative, and that's helpful. That can give us a lot of information when we make these decisions. But without that absolute number, it can be difficult to really present that in meaningful terms to the patient. So again, with the analysis, nothing that was done incorrectly here, but a potential limitation on the clinical applicability of this. We'll come back to this as we think about this later on in the discussion. So now we've laid the groundwork here a little bit for the methodology that's used. Anna's going to walk us through the results. And then after we do that, we're going to think about the conclusions that the authors come up with and how we would think through that. So Anna, why don't you walk us through some of these numbers first of all?
In this analysis, 1,073 of 2,398 trans men seen at the center were included. 431 individuals were excluded due to missing data for either the starting date of hormone therapy, and 894 were excluded due to the lack of available laboratory results. So Chase and Vin, what do you think about this and the implications of needing to, you know, exclude over half of the subjects?
It's unfortunate you had to do that, but I think the number of subjects still is pretty impressive. You're still left with close to 1,000 trans people. And I think we'll see later in the results, it's pretty consistent with what we're finding around the world. So I guess the bottom line, I mean, if the results were not consistent, what we were finding in the rest of Europe and America, then I'd be very concerned. But since there's still a very large number of subjects still left, and the results still remain pretty consistent with what other people find, I can live with excluding half.
Yeah, I like Vin's point there, is that even though they excluded a large number of people, you still had a ton of people in this study. So that is definitely a good point there. Yeah, you do always get worried when you exclude that many people, as if there is something unique about those individuals that is leading to this exclusion. Or is there a reason that you're missing laboratory results or don't have that data available? And if that's somehow linked to being more or less likely to have the outcome. So you do wonder when that number of people get excluded, if that's somehow affecting the results. But again, Vin made a great point, is when we put this in the context of a larger body of evidence, that helps you get a sense of, okay, does this seem right, or is this way off? And that, I think, would be one of the important Hill criteria that you would want to think of with observational studies, is how does that compare, and gives you a sense of, is this particularly worrisome? So I agree, not ideal, but no major red flags that this is skewing the results one way or the other.
Great. So of all the hematocrit measurements, 1,087 were during the use of testosterone gel, 1,826 were during the use of short-acting injections, 345 were drawn during the use of long-acting testosterone undecanoate injections, 150 were drawn under oral testosterone administration, and for 2,120 measurements, the testosterone administration route was unknown. The median age at the start of treatment was 22.5, with an average BMI of 24.5. 38% of patients used tobacco, and 8.6% had conditions associated with erythrocytosis, you know, obstructive sleep apnea, pulmonary conditions that we've already mentioned. Vin, how does this compare and contrast to the patients that you see in the U.S.?
In terms of the testosterone dosing, you know, most of the people in the United States are on parenteral, the shorter acting testosterones. And I think that you probably see that in your practice, Anna, right?
Yep.
We have very few on the long acting testosterone decanoate. I mean, it is available and FDA approved here in the United States, but it's under a REMS prescribing system. And it's really hard to convince someone to take it, especially with the black box warning of the pulmonary oral embolus. I think usually this discussion ends there. But apparently in Europe, I mean, I guess it's not as a concern, and they don't have as many issues with that. So it is more popular, I think. I think many of the people on the long-acting testosterone decanoate, which is so convenient, it's like a shot every 10 to 12 weeks. Sure. But here, I think because of access issues, we don't use those so much. I mean, I think the breakdown is probably somewhere like 80% intramuscular and the rest cutaneous forms of testosterone.
What about the demographics of these patients, with about 40% smoking and Is that what you see?
Yeah, I was a little surprised with that 40% tobacco. I mean, I guess as Americans, you know, we I don't want to be too biased against Europeans, but I think the impression is Americans smoke a little less. I went back and looked at the strong cohort, which is the largest trans cohort in the United States. That's made up of three large Kaiser healthcare systems. And the smoking rate was about 15% currently smoking and about 15% ex-smokers. So still much less than this, even if you combine the groups. So, I mean, that is a problem. So, I mean, probably should not smoke and take testosterone. That'll cause problems, I'm sure.
So a single measurement of a hematocrit of 50 occurred in 24% of the trans men, and 11.1% had this measurement twice. Hematocrit levels of 52 were seen in 7.6% of the patients in this cohort, and 3.7% had this level twice. And hematocrit levels of 54 were seen in 2.2% of patients once and 0.5% twice. So compared with testosterone gel, the use of the long-acting undecanoate injections showed the highest odds for being associated with a hematocrit greater than 50, with the short-acting parenteral injections and oral administration having similar odds for a hematocrit above 50 compared with testosterone gel. Mm-hmm. So Vin, you already discussed that testosterone undecanoate is not very popular in the U.S. Are you surprised that it has this association with an increased risk for a higher hematocrit?
I guess I'm not too surprised. I mean, I would imagine it's probably due to just better compliance, and you're taking it every 10 to 12 weeks. Some of my patients don't always get it every 10 to 14 days. They miss, or with the gels, they often miss. So I think with missing dosages, they're not getting the full amount of testosterone. And my guess is that's why the hematocrit response isn't as dramatic, I think. With the long-acting testosterone undecanoate, 4 or 5 shots a year, you're going to get your testosterone in.
And so then tobacco use showed higher odds for being associated with hematocrit levels above 50 and 52 when compared with no tobacco use. And older age at initiation of testosterone, high BMI, and predisposing medical history were also not surprisingly associated with higher hematocrit levels. The largest increase in hematocrit was seen in the first year after initiation of testosterone, and a slight increase was seen over time until 20 years. And finally, after 1 year, the cumulative risk of developing hematocrit levels above 50 was 8%. After 10 years, 38%. And at the end of the follow-up period, after 14 years, the cumulative incidence was 50%. So I was surprised by that. I thought that was fairly high.
Yeah, but I think it's a little bit reassuring that, you know, if you're past the first year, you're probably out of the woods. But you're right. I mean, half the people at least hitting a high hematocrit over 14 years, that is a little high, 50%. Maybe, you know, they have much longer follow-up periods there. I mean, that cohort is a very old cohort. Maybe we're not seeing that here in the States because we just don't have that long follow-up period.
Good. Yeah. So now we're going to think about the discussion and conclusion part of this paper. So we're first of all going to look at what the authors conclude from their results, and we'll give you some of our thoughts along the way and our impression of these results. So first of all, to hit the main points that the authors make, so their big point that they drive home is that using that definition of erythrocytosis as a hematocrit above 50, and that having had to occur twice, 11% of individuals in this study met that outcome. So they concluded that was relatively frequent occurrence there. And then in addition to that, besides testosterone itself, those determinants of that outcome were smoking, age, BMI, and that predisposing history. And we'll come back to the authors at the very end, have a nice summary of how they would recommend putting some of this research into action based on that. So we'll come back to those highlighted issues there. And as we've mentioned several times before, the authors here point out that the prevalence of erythrocytosis in this study is similar to that found in research of other trans men populations. And so they thought that this, while this expanded, and particularly with the large numbers that they have, would give more concrete numbers, it does fit with the larger body of evidence that's out there. One thing that they do point out, we've talked about this already as well, is that in particular, that long-acting undecanoate injection showed the highest odds for hematocrit greater than 50%. And they show that this is in line with previous studies in particular, that the transdermal testosterone showed the least increase on this. So a couple different things that I think that we should be thinking about here. And Van already gave us some speculation as to what might be going on. It may just be potentially people taking the testosterone consistently, not missing any doses, and that's possibly what drives that. Van, any other thoughts on any other mechanisms beyond just consistency of taking testosterone that may be a driver for this erythrocytosis that we see here?
Yeah, I was looking to see what has been known about the pathophysiology about testosterone and causing erythrocytosis. And you know, we know that testosterone somehow directly or indirectly stimulates erythropoietin, and that obviously stimulates red blood cells in the bone marrow. But recently, I've come across some studies that testosterone may also suppress hepcidin, and suppressing hepcidin allows more free iron to be released in the blood, and that might also promote erythrocytosis. So my thought is perhaps the long-acting testosterone decanoate, and I'm just speculating here, you asked me to speculate, maybe that has a stronger effect on suppressing hepcidin, and that's, you know, produced in the liver. That's my guess. It's surprising to see that people really don't know the exact mechanism how testosterone stimulates erythrocytosis. There are a lot of fascinating studies where we've looked at men where they've given men testosterone and they looked at erythropoietin levels, and their studies are mixed. Some stimulate erythropoietin, some don't. And so there may be some direct or indirect effect, but I think it's fascinating with this hepcidin story. Maybe the long-acting testosterone decanoate does something to hepcidin that the short-acting ones don't. So that's my only speculation at this point.
And we're going to come back in the end here because I'm going to ask Anna and Van in particular that with these numbers, you know, we don't know what the absolute numbers based on this would be, but at least an odds ratio substantially above other forms of testosterone. So we're going to come back to this in the end thinking, is this going to provide us data to say, even if this were more readily available and more easy to prescribe in the United States, how they would think about that. So we'll come back to that here shortly. A couple of other points that the authors make, though, first of all, is that they point out that a nice dose response was demonstrated. So in particular, that when comparing those with testosterone levels in the target range, that lower levels had lower risk of erythrocytosis, higher levels had a higher risk. And I do think that is an important thing to point out. We mentioned Hill criteria. That's that list of criteria, a historical list that you can go through to help you decide if observational data fits with experience and other research that's out there. This would be one of the ways that you look at it, is if you have a concern that an exposure generates an outcome, that more of that exposure should give you more of that outcome. And that's exactly what we see here. So this would be information that would suggest that, yeah, this is an accurate understanding of the numbers that are out there. So another comment, we've touch base on this just very briefly, and this was a caveat that the authors mentioned, is that it's not actually clear what the upper limit for testosterone levels should be. There were several different ones that were defined here. The 54% was largely adapted from the hypogonadism, the male hypogonadism guidelines, because that's what's used there, but it's not clear if that should be used or if it should be more conservative of 50 or if it's somewhere in the middle at 52%. So Van, thoughts on this? Is this a total unknown as to where we get worried about that cutoff for erythrocytosis or what should we be using in clinical care?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we know the exact cutoff. I mean, I think it makes sense to, I mean, we don't want to be hitting 60. I mean, that's my guess. I don't know if we're that kind of study. But I mean, I think 54 is kind of keeping below 54 is reasonable. I mean, from the strong cohort, the cohort I mentioned, the largest in the United States, you know, they also published in the Journal of the Endocrine Society some hematocrit data. And using the Endocrine Society guidelines, there weren't any extreme elevations in hematocrit following the guidance of trying to keep it under 54. I don't know if we will know the answer. I mean, I think the risks outweigh the benefits of trying to push it much above 54. Most people get to a therapeutic level of testosterone without hematocrits above 54. So I think it's still reasonable. Keep it at 54. I don't know if we're going to ever get the kind of data we need to know the exact amount. Fortunately, there are not a lot of outcomes that indicate harm with high hematocrit. We don't see the kind of MI and stroke and DVT PE data in the trans population. We're extrapolating from the cisgender populations that higher hematocrit may cause thromboembolism, but fortunately in trans men, we don't see that. So that is reassuring. So I think 54 is good. I wouldn't push it much more. We might see more side effects if we do, I think.
And one last main point that the authors make here that Vin alluded to already is that that largest increase in hematocrit does occur in the first year after testosterone initiation, though they do point out that it really can occur at any time, and it can be many, many years out that you discover that for the first time, but mostly in that first year after initiation. A few limitations. We'll start with the ones that the authors point out, but then we'll discuss some ones that we might also consider to be limitations. So first of all, authors say retrospective study always a limitation there to some degree, particularly because quite a bit of the data was missing and nothing that you could do as a retrospective data to collect that. They also mentioned that there were several potential confounders that could not be studied. We suggested that socioeconomic status could be one of those important ones. They mentioned that often the route of testosterone administration was unknown at the time that the labs were collected, and in particular that very few individuals had hematocrit levels above 54%, so that actually couldn't really be analyzed very well. Most of the analysis, the numbers that we discussed, were using those cutoffs of 50 and 52% because of how few individuals got above 54. The duration of erythrocytosis was also not something that could be accurately determined with the information that they had. A few other things, and I'll mention a couple that I had thought of. We talked about the first one already, is that still not knowing what those absolute risks are, and so potentially limiting the applicability of this information. Another one is that there really isn't any data that is on clot risk here, so either a venous thromboembolism or atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And it may just be because there was very few, or because that's not data that was collected, but that's obviously one of the main, if not the main outcome that you worry about with erythrocytosis, is that it causes an embolic event. And so it's hard to know, if we don't have any of that outcome, if that's a major concern or not here. But Anna, Vin, any other thoughts that you guys have, potential limitations or at least other things that you would have liked to have seen to really be able to determine the accuracy of these results?
Just one other thing. So when I'm deciding what type of testosterone I want to start somebody on, the other question I will ask them is their family history, is do they have a family history of clotting ASCVD that they know of? If they do have a positive family history, I don't look at that as a contraindication, but it might make me lean away from doing like undecanoate or injectable testosterone.
I think these findings also justify measuring baseline hematocrit to follow people over time. But I also want to mention that the Endocrine Society commissioned a systematic review in 2017 that was a companion to the guidelines, and they didn't find any increased cardiovascular disease in trans men, which I guess is reassuring. I agree with you, Chase, that it would have been nice to have some of the cardiovascular outcomes presented in this paper, but I suspect that's going to be presented in another paper. So much is coming out of this cohort. But as far as I understand, this cohort hasn't seen increased cardiovascular disease outcomes in trans men.
And where we're going to end with is where the authors end their paper. They have a very nice section at the end, which I really liked what they did, which is their implications for clinical practice, and that's specifically for when erythrocytosis develops. I think it was a nice feature, observational studies. It can often be uncertain as to exactly what we should take from that, if it's a situation where we're going to say, well, we need more research before we do anything, or if we can say, no, there is actionable information here. There is something that we should be doing to change that. Now, I think we always need to look at that critically and make sure that makes sense, but I do like that the author suggested that. So I'm just going to go through initially the ones that they recommend, and then I'll kick it over to Vin and to Anna to think through those, and then also any other implications of this information. So what they suggest is, if you have patients that you're treating, trans men patients, and you're treating them and erythrocytosis develops, that they say a few different things to think about. So one is if they're on injection form of testosterone, you'd want to think about switching that to a different form. That if their BMI is above 25, you'd want to think about recommending weight loss. One that's been mentioned several times already, that if they're smoking, you want to recommend smoking cessation. And then if they have any other underlying lung disease, sleep apnea has been brought up a few times, that you would certainly want to think about treating that. So as we wrap up here, Anna and Vin, let's start. First of all, just the quality of this report overall. Vin's mentioned several times already that quite a good group and a lot of good information is coming out of this group to inform care in this area. But how would you all describe the quality of this report?
We can learn a lot from this very old cohort. I think if they were to set it up again now, it'd probably be set up differently. But, you know, we learned so much, and I think they have done the best they can with the data they have. There is another cohort. I think this group is part of called Energy, which is a multinational cohort, which is taking data and lab and different health outcomes in a more prospective way. And I think we're going to hear more about outcomes from that study. That's mostly a European cohort. But for this cohort, I think given its limitations, we could still learn a lot from this cohort.
And then where I want to end hearing from both of you is thinking about these recommendations. Let's circle back. We've mentioned the issues with the testosterone undecanoate. So I'd like to also hear your thoughts on that with that substantially nearly three times of an odds of risk of erythrocytosis. So what do you all think about these recommendations that are provided here? And then also, what would your thoughts be about if you were able to more readily prescribe undecanoate? Is that something that, given this data, that you would still consider, or that you would have substantial concerns about?
Sure, I'll jump in. So I think switching from injections is very reasonable. I think another thing that one could consider is typically these injections are given once every week, once every 2 weeks. I think if patients are willing to do smaller doses of testosterone more frequently, that may be associated with a decreased risk of high testosterone levels and associated high hematocrit levels. I think for a lot of patients, the injectable testosterone may be cheaper than transdermal testosterone. So I do keep that in mind. Certainly, I recommend weight loss and stopping smoking, but sometimes those things are mutually exclusive. When one stops smoking, they gain weight. So as an endocrinologist, I also treat a lot of patients who have type 2 diabetes and obesity. So I feel very comfortable going over weight loss medications if those are warranted, especially if patients have a BMI above 30 or a BMI above 27 with a weight-related condition.
I would also add taking good sleep history. You know, sleep disorders are very common. So some of these people might report snoring, or their partners may report they stop breathing at night. So those people I usually refer for a sleep study. You know, they may benefit from CPAP or maybe some other structural sleep condition that may help the erythrocytosis. You mentioned, Chase, the phlebotomy. And no, there are no guidelines for this. But I don't know if we're treating ourselves more than a real condition, but that might be something to consider if you're having difficulty getting testosterone levels into the therapeutic range and they still have erythrocytosis. There's not a lot of data in the area, but I agree with their implications for practice. I mean, certainly have to do a workup when you have a erythrocytosis before you blame it all on testosterone. And then if it's testosterone, then you're, like Anna said, trying to find ways to deliver testosterone without stimulating the erythrocytosis as best you can.
Yeah, so Ben, then leave us with a comment on undecanoate. So it may not be often an issue because of how difficult it is to prescribe, but does this information, does this data make you hesitant in prescribing it, or not necessarily because the numbers don't compel you?
That's a tough one. I mean, undecanoate is so convenient. And the FDA labeling has made it really difficult in the United States to prescribe it. With that kind of label, I mean, I hardly have any experience with it. I think most providers are in the same boat. To have that kind of warning, most patients will not take it. And I assume it's the same compound. So I guess this data does deter me a little bit. It makes me feel like I'm not missing out with not having undecanoate here as readily available. I think the question's still out there. Is it more higher stimulus of erythrocytosis than our conventional testosterone esters that we use?
And with that, I would like to thank Anna Goldman and Finn Tang Precha for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I know you all learned a great deal and hope that you will join us again for next month's episode. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.